Our next case for this morning is Phillips v. Jack Hoffman, City of Waukesha Community Insurance Corporation. Mr. Murphy.
Good morning, Your Honors. On behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Tamara Phillips, I'm privileged to argue this appeal before this Court. And I believe that I have raised a significant constitutional question, and perhaps questions, foremost concerning the use, the police use of what's called intermediate force. In this case, the SL-6 baton launcher, which is a gunpowder-fired weapon equivalent to the propulsion of a .44 Magnum, in an overload fashion against the lady's shin bone.
So what makes something intermediate force?
That's the police. That's how they described it. It's one level short of deadly force.
But why isn't it deadly force if it can kill somebody?
That's a good question. I argued that my client's shin bone didn't know if it was deadly or intermediate when the flesh was torn off of it. As far as we're concerned, it could have been deadly.
I mean, if it hit her eye, for example, it might have been.
In fact, I think the Mercado Court, which is really the only other SL-6 case out there at the time, said it could be deadly force, but it's designed to be less lethal force.
Well, if used properly, I guess. Okay.
The expectation isn't that this weapon will cause death, whereas with a firearm, that is the expectation.
Well, this is a firearm, but...
Well,
so,
let's
and
say
I hate to split hairs, Your Honor.
All right.
But it just depends on where it's aimed at.
Correct.
I mean, that's what determines whether
correct.
It becomes
and at the end of the day, significant damage was done to my client's leg, whereby literally flesh was torn off of her legs, unrepairable, and they stopped counting at like 75 stitches for the other wounds. The key factor in this case, Your Honors, is that everybody agrees there was no imminent danger and that my client was not actively resisting arrest or actively attempting to flee, which are two of the three Graham elements.
So at the time she's shot, if I'm understanding the record correctly, she's kind of lying down across the front seat and her feet are hanging out of the car. Are they hanging through the window or are they hanging down onto the ground?
Originally, she had her feet up on the window door frame, and then she moved them where they both were on the ground, and the door was cocked open sideways.
Mm-hmm.
So her feet were out of the car, correct, and she was laying kind of across the console.
So it would have taken her a minute to swing around.
Well, the interesting, too, is that the officers admitted that when they were shooting her four times, she wasn't moving when they were shooting her, not even when she was being hit and flesh was being torn off of her legs. She wasn't reacting in any manner at that point. And I think perhaps a more specific constitutional question is, can the police use this type of a weapon under these circumstances merely to end a potentially dangerous situation, which is what I believe Captain Jack testified to, and I think the facts bear out.
But you have a high burden here. I just want to jump back to procedure for a minute because there's a trial and a jury verdict in favor of the defendant police officers. And so we're looking at rulings on a motion for judgment as a matter of law and a motion for new trial.
Correct.
Right. So those are both high hurdles.
Correct.
Are you arguing then that the use under these circumstances of the SL-6 was excessive force as a matter of law?
Correct. The facts, I believe, are undisputed. And again, just yesterday I reread counsel's brief, and there's really no facts in there that are disputed, at least material ones. This was an undisputed fact case. I put my entire liability case in through the officers. My client testified to her damages and readily admitted she basically didn't remember what happened, and that goes into the second basis for my appeal, and that was the admission of the blood alcohol content evidence, which was discovered after the fact. And I did everything possible to try to keep that out, including offering to stipulate basically to anything they wanted to prove about it, except that it was a .30.
Because why was that harmful? I mean, the jury must have known that she was that the police had responded to reports of somebody driving under the influence of alcohol. I mean, there's a lot already in the record suggesting that she was drunk.
Well, again, that's suspicion because there was no personal contact with this driver before the incident. 911 calls did come in from citizens to say, this lady's all over the road, assuming she was drunk. And I guess the officers could even presume she was drunk. But We do have cases from this circuit and from around the country of medical reasons which cause this type of driving, including diabetic comas and the McAllister and Smith cases that were before this court.
But what,
as well.
What, where do we go with that fact? I mean, I thought your basic argument was here's this motionless person, and maybe even one shot would have been okay, but the fact that she doesn't respond, and that the police have, what is it, 7 patrol cars surrounding the area, so she's not really going anywhere.
Correct.
Even if she did turn around and try to drive, is what makes it unreasonable.
I agree. I believe that all the facts, material facts, are undisputed, and that this court can therefore pronounce judgment on it. If this was a case where the jury found some facts over my client's versions of the facts, I wouldn't be here.
I want to back you up procedurally just a little bit. Judge Wood referred to a judgment as a matter of law. Did you move for judgment as a matter of law at the close of the plaintiff's case?
Not during the trial, but at the end of the trial I did.
You moved JNOV.
Correct.
After the verdict.
Correct.
But not prior to the verdict.
Correct.
Nor did you seek summary judgment on liability prior to trial.
Correct. I just opposed theirs. But
so
frankly,
we have a forfeiture then of this argument that you're making? Because this is really the JNOV really is the first time you've made the argument that as a matter of law, your client has to win on the facts.
My perspective is that when I'm familiar with the rule that Your Honor is mentioning, is that that's typically a defense posture verdict situation. And frankly, I could have perhaps even moved for summary judgment, but I thought this case was best left to the...
Because really you're asking us to determine, as a matter of law, the use of this SL6 on a person who is not physically interacting with the law enforcement in resistance would be excessive force.
I agree.
That would be a pretty strong rule.
Perhaps, but I think the facts of this case are so egregious that it would warrant that.
So you also moved for a new trial.
I did,
right?
And that was based upon the admission of the BAC evidence. There were some other contentious issues, but I haven't appealed those. But I think the BAC evidence here was so highly inflammatory because the jury found out exactly how dangerous she was.
Well, I guess that's the problem I have with that because, as Judge Wood alluded to, there was other evidence not objected to in the record about the small tequila bottle, what, a shot and a half or an ounce and a half, something like that, empty. The odor of alcohol, the way she was acting, even after the arrest, that would have suggested a high level of intoxication. The .30 or whatever it was, 307, really just quantified that. And it's hard for me to see how that's prejudicial to you when there's all this other evidence of extreme intoxication.
I believe I did object to what I'm calling the after-acquired evidence once they have her in custody, basically, including that. But that stuff is not as inflammatory as the jury, you know, is it a .13, 1.5, .30, holy crap, she's driving around my community. And I offered to stipulate. The reasoning was that we're going to let that in because it's going to corroborate the officer's testimony. But I said we don't need to corroborate because I'm not attacking. I'm presenting it. Therefore, it's bolstering. I offered to stipulate to the couple of exceptions that her memory was impaired, her judgment was impaired, and all of that. And no one accepted that. And instead, we went forward with the only reason that could be used is to be inflammatory. And if I may reserve my time, thank you.
Ms. Zabawa.
Good morning. My name is Barbara Zabawa, and I'm representing Officers Russell Jack and James Hoffman. The appellant started out saying that these facts are undisputed. The facts, he's leaving out a lot of facts, actually.
Well, let me just ask you this. Why was it reasonable to keep shooting her after the first time when she wasn't moving, she had no basic reaction, they had a strong suspicion she was drunk? And why did they have to fire that? I mean, I know the first time it was fired at the car, a big dent was made at the car, so she doesn't move. So they fire one more time. That first shot, that second shot, did hit her leg.
Right.
Why was there a need to keep shooting?
The officers testified that they'd perceived her as moving. Remember, they viewed this as a stolen vehicle. So
well,
they treated this.
That's even a little ambiguous, but let's just give you that. But I think taking the facts as a whole, because actually in this dispatch that you give us, or that's in the plaintiff's brief, it turns out that they find out that this car is registered to her. But anyway, there are also the seven squad cars.
Mm-hmm.
And the report in the dispatch about we've got her, she's stabilized in the car, or something to that effect. That's not exact, but
right,
like
that's right.
Right. Officer Jack testified that he used those words meaning that the car has stopped. The car had been traveling about town for several miles, and the jury got to see the route that the car took based on the calls coming in from citizens. And when Officer Jack and Hoffman arrived, they were the first on the scene. Officer Jack radioed that we have the car, it's stabilized. His choice
of
words.
That's not what he says, though. He says, we have the person. I'm looking at page 15. We have the person secured here, not in cuffs, but stabilized in the car. That's not the car is stabilized. That's the person is stabilized.
But what he meant, remember, this is a busy Friday night. An intense situation. They got a report that it was a stolen car, and although, yes, it turned out it wasn't stolen, they did not know that until well after.
So we give you all of that. So
no,
I
we
still
right.
get back to my
yeah,
question.
That's right.
They hit the car. It's dented. She
mm-hmm.
doesn't move. They hit her leg the first time. She doesn't move. There's clearly a wound after the first time. I want to know why did they have to fire those next shots? Why was that reasonable?
Officer Hoffman testified that she did move after the first shot. She reached down towards her leg and yelled. And on cross-exam, he testified in response to this question, whether the appellant was incapacitated or unable to respond after being shot with the SL-6, and I quote, no, because she had been moving around the whole time. Incapacitated to me seems that, you know, the person would be passed out, incapable of responding. He dismissed the possibility of her being passed out.
But he waits 3 seconds between shots. That's actually a pretty long time. And she's not in any way making threatening motions. She might be squirming. You know, if he's surprised that he's hurt her leg, I wonder about his basic common sense. If somebody's got an enormous gash in their leg, most people do feel pain.
Well, at that point, I don't think the testimony reveals that Officer Hoffman knew that he had caused a big gash in her leg.
Well, he hears her cry out.
Well, because the point of using the SL-6, remember, they had been at the scene for 10 minutes before they decided to pull out the SL-6.
Yeah, and the SL-6, I mean, actually, I'm going to make this broad point that has nothing to do, well, it has everything to do with this case, but nothing in a way. Which is to call the SL-6 something non-lethal would be like to say a .44 Magnum is a non-lethal weapon. You could point it at your foot. You're not going to kill somebody, probably, if you shoot them in the foot. But that SL-6 is not like a baton.
Actually, the Waukesha Police Department, well, the officers in this case, testified that it is the same level of force as a baton.
But it isn't. It's going at the velocity. Do you think people hit batons at a velocity of 1,500 feet per second?
No. But
no,
they did testify that they use the SL-6 when they are 40 to 50 feet away from the target, whereas batons are used when they are up in front of the person.
They're not good physicists then, because the amount of force that comes out of the SL-6 is so vastly in excess of what even a very strong person could exert that they are risking a lot more lawsuits like this with grievous harm to people who may not be threatening at all.
But this
is like litigating. I don't know, but it's really a very dangerous weapon.
Well, the officers are highly trained in its use, and they know not to use it below, above the belly button, I think they said.
This was the first time this officer had used one?
Yes.
Yes. So I don't know about highly trained either, but...
Well, they did go through training before they actually brought it out to use. And the standard, of course, is what was reasonable at the time, and there was...
Exactly. That's definitely the standard.
And because I'm still trying to picture the scene, because her legs are on the ground, the car door, I assume, is pressed against. I mean, is the car door, like, wide open and they have a total view of her, or isn't the car door resting on her legs?
I don't know that fine detail. It was ajar. Her legs were out.
Her legs were out.
Mm-hmm.
I still can't get past. He hits her the first time. She screams, and then he continues. So maybe I could even give you the second one. But he makes the target. He clearly knows how to hit the target because he hit her a second time. Mm-hmm. He doesn't stop then. Why is the next shot not reasonable?
When they decide to use any force, SL6 or regardless of the type of force, they use it to get compliance and control of the situation.
I just don't understand why they're not in control. She's laying down. Her leg has been hit twice.
Because this is viewed as a stolen car, a high-risk traffic stop. They do not know if other occupants are in the car or if there are weapons in the car. And remember, the whole time that they are there, when they're asking her repeatedly, 50 to 60 times, raise your hands, exit the vehicle.
But we have cases where people are in, as we were saying, in diabetic comas. We have cases. So if somebody is, does that mean you're looking like kill someone who's unconscious? I don't know how far they go with this non-responsiveness.
The facts in our case are not showing someone who is incapable of responding to officer commands. She's lighting a cigarette. She's putting a water bottle on the sidewalk. She's moving about the interior of the car, reaching for the glove box. While they are shouting, and the officers in court...
So they have to maim her. They can shoot. I mean, again, nobody, I think, is really pushing you too much on that first shot. But if once her leg is injured, where is she going to go?
Well, and I don't understand. As I understand it, it's seven cars surrounding her. So I assume they're in a circle around the vehicle. So, like... I mean, maybe I watch too much TV, but somebody like sneak up on one side? She's got her legs going in one direction. I mean, how is she going to contort so she can get somebody in the back? Can't somebody inch up on the side? They didn't view anybody, these cars. I mean, I assume they have binoculars in the car. They can look in there and see. Does she have dark tinted dark tinted windows, so they couldn't like use binoculars to see if somebody else was in the car?
That was not in the evidence. What it was in the evidence was that it was dark. It was 7 o'clock in November, so it's dark. And it's a residential neighborhood. And this is going on for 10 minutes. They're shouting at her.
So don't they carry like lights? You know, those
the lights were on her car, but they
right.
the officers
I mean in terms of then therefore if the lights were on the car, I assume the lights were on the car, you know, through the glass so you could see if anybody else was in there. I know it's not optimal, perfect conditions, but I assume there were lots of lights on that car.
The lights were from the officers' vehicles.
Right.
And they did not know if anyone was in the back seat ducking down. They did not know if any weapons were in the car. And what led them to wonder about that was the fact that they were dealing with a stolen car. And they testified in court that stolen cars are treated as high risk because they're dangerous. And they're dangerous because of the people who drive them. And the people who drive them commit other serious crimes.
But they'd already had reports of this car really being all over the place, not as though it was attempting an escape or a high-speed chase, but weaving, and citizen reports that would really lead to just one conclusion, that there was somebody really blotto in that car.
But it was also reported as stolen, and
then they find out there's some ambiguity in the report of the stolen. They can't figure out why the plates were. I found the part in the transcript I was
exactly
talking about, say.
It was a confusing situation. Officer Jack testified that it's impossible in his mind for the Department of Transportation or Motor Vehicles to transfer a license plate that comes up listed as stolen
another
vehicle.
Mistakes
that should never happen.
The listed owner in the Nissan Maxima is the complainant for the vehicle theft in the Honda Civic, silver in color, with that plate assigned, so I'm unsure why that plate is reassigned to the Nissan Maxima. Acknowledgement. So... It's a messy situation.
The car is effectively surrounded. There's no way for the car to go backwards because there's a drop-off, and there's seven police vehicles around it.
But the officers testified that they viewed that car as running and pointing at them, and that it would have been very easy for her to just step on the gas and injure them.
Their legs hanging out the window. She would have had to turn around. The minute they see her turning around, maybe they think that's happening. But I don't know how to drive a car unless I did it with my hand while my legs are hanging out the window.
Don't go home and try that.
I don't plan on it.
The officers testified what they reasonably perceived that night.
Well, what they perceived. I guess we're asking reasonably
what they perceived was someone who was behind the wheel, who was capable of responding to their commands and did not.
Who needs to move before she can drive. Right. They, according to their testimony, she would need to reposition herself significantly before she could drive.
Yes, but it wouldn't take very long for her to do that if that's what she
was. Did any of the cars have video cameras in them that were showing you? So you didn't have any video?
No, we did not have the advantage of any police cameras, only photographs of the scene afterwards to give the jury a picture of what it looked like. And the cars, by the way, the police cars were not surrounding her. They were the officer Jack and Hoffman testified how they set up a high-risk traffic stop with flanker cars on the sides, and then Officer Jack and Hoffman were in the middle. I believe there were a couple of flanker cars on each side and maybe ones further down the road to protect citizens
really
from coming
the
into
routes,
the scene.
To eliminate the routes that car could have gone.
There was, it could have gone forward. Remember, it was up pointing at them with the car running. That's what they perceived. That's what they testified, that it was still running, and that to them was a weapon. As far as the BAC evidence, I would like to just say that there was a limiting instruction when that was provided, and the appellants never objected to the limiting instruction. In fact, they suggested it.
Why is that relevant, though, or what does that add, since our focus has to be on information available to the police at the time they effectuate these stops? So they have the citizen complaints, they have the weaving. I don't see why after acquired evidence is appropriate to come in, even with a limiting. You can't send in irrelevant evidence, even if you say, and ladies and gentlemen of the jury, please disregard this irrelevant evidence I'm letting in.
The officers viewed this evidence as corroborating the testimony that had already been provided. The appellant
doesn't corroborate anything from their perspective. They're not allowed to use facts that are developed later on.
But as you noted earlier, they did perceive someone who was intoxicated. They had information.
What the jury is supposed to make the decision on is the information they had before this all went down to judge whether or not their conduct was reasonable or unreasonable.
So the jury can't
corroborate. Just having this blood alcohol of 0.3 give us some other reason it was relevant.
Well, we cite Saladino v. Winkler for the proposition that this court allowed evidence of intoxication. Granted, it wasn't a BAC measure, but it was intoxication that helped show that the plaintiff acted as the defendant officers contend that she did. And that is what we were bringing it in for.
The defendant officers had no firsthand knowledge anyway of the weaving. That had come in through the dispatch and through the report, so there was no perception of the officers that needed corroboration.
Well, they did perceive her while she was in the car acting very strangely, odd, as Officer Hoffman called her, when she lit the cigarette and put the water bottle down and was just moving around and not complying with their commands. They testified that when someone doesn't comply with their commands, that raises their threat assessment. And so they had...
Well, the BAC evidence is of no use to that either.
It does go to the unpredictability and uncertainty of the person's behavior.
Yeah, but they didn't know about it.
They didn't know that she... I mean, your case depends on their not knowing that she was this incapacitated, because their perception that she might have been a threat is vitally dependent on the fact that she was just as able as anyone here today. So it seems like the BAC evidence is quite irrelevant.
Well, our position is that the limiting instruction mitigated any prejudicial effect that it might have had.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Murphy?
Which, interestingly, that 0.30 does kind of help your case, doesn't it?
It's a double-edged sword, I think, or shield, I don't know, whatever you want to call it.
I understand you argue that the shooting was excessive force. Are you also arguing that forcing her to walk backwards after she was shot is part of the excessive force?
I am, Your Honor, and as the record will reflect, again, undisputed, after the fourth shot, and in the police words, she slumps out of the vehicle. Mm-hmm. They order her back on her feet, walk backwards, or you're going to get shot again, and then come back and kneel down for us back here.
And so that was part of your force. And did you argue that to the jury as well?
Certainly. And I've argued some of the several things I've heard today, in fact. But there was one thing I really wanted to point out, and the officer's brief in a couple spots saying, well, she was moving the whole time we were on scene, but the testimony, and I found one spot in particular, Officer Hoffman.
And the transcript where?
In the transcript. This is the volume 2 of the jury transcript from 2010, page 240, line 17. My redirect by Mr. Murphy. Question. She wasn't moving between shots 1 and 4. Her feet were out the door on the ground, right? Answer, yes. And that's one that I was able to quickly flip to, but the testimony was undisputed. She was moving around when they got there, when they were setting up, but when the shots started firing, she had become unresponsive. And in terms of the BAC ruling, if I may, Your Honor, there is an excerpt from the judge's original ruling from 9/29/2009 at the final pretrial conference, I believe it was docket number 171, page 18, where the court said, basically, I'm going to let the BAC stuff in because of corroboration, but the court, I think, uses an improper standard. The court says, well, there's no question that whether or not officers engaged in unreasonable conduct depends upon the totality of the circumstances as they understood it. So that's a subjective test. I think the trial court therefore allowed this BAC evidence in under a subjective test where Graham calls for an objective test. And I think there's several examples of the officers and the district court using subjective analysis where Graham calls for an objective analysis. And if I may make one more point, the officers ask basically, is it reasonable for an officer to believe that disobeying a police order is resistive behavior at page 29 of their brief? Or, as I would put it, is a failure to obey a police command tantamount to active resistance under Graham? I don't think it is, and under Wisconsin law, I don't think it is, and I found Wisconsin J.I. Criminal, the standard jury instruction, 1765. I apologize, I don't believe I have it in my brief, but I think the court could take judicial notice of that document. It says, to resist an officer means to oppose the officer by force or threat of force. The resistance must be directed to the officer personally. So I think under Wisconsin law, the answer is no. Disobeying a police order is not resisting arrest by itself. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.